I'm David Korn.
And I'm Jim Pinkerton.
And we're Blogging Heads TV. Nerds and geeks, are we? And you believe, we make fools of ourselves doing that for absolutely no money.
And all for the greater glory of Bob Wright. Who could imagine that that's how we spend our career, glorifying him?
I know. Anything to build up the old resume. Well, I'm a bit flustered today because I literally have just run up Capitol Hill to my office all the way from the Federal District Courthouse, where I've been watching the Libby trial, and today was probably the trial day from hell. Not just for those watching, but also for the person in the witness chair, Judy Miller.
who deserves a soft life after all that she's been through, all the privations she suffered on behalf of the First Amendment.
I was feeling sorry for her today. I really was. I mean, and I think this was the day that Patrick Fitzgerald, the special counsel, always considered the day we just have to get through. And it's unfortunately not even over for him or for Judy Miller.
She'll be back tomorrow?
Yeah, she'll be back tomorrow because I don't think the defense is yet through with her. I'll give you a short recap here. And she came on under questioning from Patrick Fitzgerald, who, of course, is not anyone who she is too fond of, given that he threw her in jail for 85 days. And if you don't know that, you shouldn't be watching Blogging Heads TV to begin with. Go to ESPN, please, because I'm not explaining all the backstory here. And he took her through the part of the story that's important for him, that she had three separate conversations with Scooter Libby in which he talked about Joe Wilson and mentioned Valerie Wilson, Joe Wilson's wife. These were all, you know, off the record or background conversations. Not to be quoted, and they happened on June 23rd, 2003, July 8th at the St. Regis Hotel. Boy, we should get a free room for that. July 8th, 2003, and then July 12th, 2003, where she was talking to Scooter Libby from her home in Sag Harbor, New York, out in the Hamptons. And what this does is it proves Fitzgerald's contention that Scooter Libby, or I should say prove, but it bolsters his contention, that Scooter Libby, you know, was well aware about Valerie Wilson and was talking about her to other reporters and actually leaking this information, despite the fact that Libby claims that when he was talking to reporters in the beginning of the second week of July 2003, he didn't know anything about Valerie Wilson. He had heard about her from Dick Cheney a month earlier, but had completely forgotten that. This, you know, Fitzgerald is just out there showing that he actively sought information on her and him and then traded it or shared it or passed it along to other reporters. And, you know, she is one of the many legs of the case. And she was walked through the testimony by Fitzgerald and said really nothing that we didn't know already from the indictment and from things that she's written about and from what Michael Isikoff and I put in the book Hubris. There were no revelations today in her testimony. Then came the cross-examination. And this, again, completely expected. As they've done with other witnesses, they were challenging her memory. And it turns out, again, this is not a surprise, we knew this going in, that her first meeting with Scooter Libby, June 23rd, in the old executive office building, was something that she had forgotten to tell the grand jury the first time she appeared. She remembered two conversations in July, and she was asked to go back, look at your notes, and see if you can find anything else out about those conversations. In doing that, she came upon a notebook showing that she had met him, talked to him on June 23rd, and she immediately called her lawyer, immediately called Fitzgerald, and they called her back to a second grand jury appearance, which she testified what happened there. And this one is probably the most significant meeting because it's the first one. So what did the cross-examination, defense attorneys do during cross? They said, wow, isn't this interesting? You didn't remember that at the grand jury. You didn't remember that for all those 2 years that you were fighting to stay out of jail. You didn't remember this conversation when you were in jail protecting Scooter Libby. And now, all of a sudden, you remember this conversation, not just what's in your notes, which may have refreshed your recollection. You remember what Scooter Libby said to you, what his demeanor was, what his attitude was. You didn't remember this for like a whole two-year period. Now, how could you remember that so clearly now? And I'm being a little gentle here in describing this, but they went on and on and on about that and about her memory, and they pulled quotes, somewhat selectively, sometimes not so, from her grand jury appearance, in which she talked about how she had sometimes had problems with her memory, but often that was in response to a specific item. Here they're making her sound about as daft as one can be, as if she's just, you know, a step away from the home for people with Alzheimer's. And I got to tell you, I mean, it was somewhat hard to watch, and I felt sympathetic for her, because I think it's almost something that you could do with anybody testifying about something a few years later. But here was the odd event in which she had forgotten one of her three conversations with Scooter Libby. And the fact that she had forgotten that had given bloggers, particularly liberal bloggers, you know, a lot of cause and a lot of reason to attack her, trying to protect Scooter and, you know, not remember the most important conversation and what's really up with her memory. This is all too convenient. I tell you, she looked pretty believable on the stand today when she was being sliced and diced by the Libby lawyers.
Well, I mean, that's interesting, and you've been doing a terrific job of following this case at davidkorn.org.
Com,
I guess it is. I mean, you know, it's funny how the conventional wisdom on this case has changed. A month ago, all the spin coming out of Washington, at least, was, you know, this is a political prosecution. You know, Fitzgerald is just prosecutors going after poor Libby, and any number of prominent big shots, including some who are not seen as neocons, were parading around saying, you know, Bush should pardon Libby and get this thing over with, and so on and so on and so on. That was sort of the conventionalism, I think, up until Fitzgerald's opening statement.
Yeah.
And again, you've been there, and so, you know, and I haven't. Then I think the new conventionalism says, wow, Fitzgerald really did nail Libby on the fairly narrow, but of course nonetheless serious, because it's always serious when you lie to the government under oath, business. It does seem like this parade of witnesses, including Ari Fleischer, and I loved it, David, when you said that he no longer had his escorts of spin and deception with him.
Spin and denial. He has his old friends.
Yeah, we all have those friends when we work in the White House.
He's used to handling questioning, isn't he? But he was very good on the stand. And this is, I'm not a lawyer, and sometimes I play one on Blogging Hits TV, but this seems to me to be a classic case where the defense team can get up there and impeach the credibility individually of every single witness, because no one has a perfect memory. And you can always say, well, you said this at one point and said that at another point. What are we to believe? Can you tell me the color of the tie he wore that day that you met with him? Oh, you can't? Well, then how do you know what he said? You know, defense attorneys always do this. But in this instance, what Fitzgerald is betting on is that, as you put it, this parade of witnesses will come forward with their memories all pointing in the very same direction. And, you know, maybe one or two might be selectively remembering things inaccurately, but can all of them, can 50,000 Elvis fans be wrong? Can they all be, you know, misremembering, you know, this? I mean, that's kind of, you know, what the defense is going to have to be forced to argue.
After a while, you conclude, look, Elvis ate a lot of fattening food. This is all there is to it.
Yes, and after all, you conclude. Listen, they all, you know, Libby couldn't have forgotten all of this. These guys can't all be, you know, forgetting, you know, inaccurately when they claim to have told him about Valerie Wilson, and he claims it didn't happen. And so Wells is also trying to do other things other than just the memory defense. He's trying to create competing narratives that don't make sense. He's trying to claim that Scooter Libby was set up by Carl Rove, of all people. I can't even begin to explain this, because
that takes to the third bit of the new conventionalism.
Yes,
is, I think, isn't it? Without really arguing against one or two, but the third one has been piled on, is what a snake pit this White House is.
Yeah, and it isn't so much snake pit, but you do, you know, there have been some insights into the way the Vice President's office works, and you show that it's been demonstrated, in fact, by stuff submitted by Scooter Libby's side, that, you know, Dick Cheney was really quite hands-on. I know that's not a big shock out there, but he was, like, you know, helping Scooter get talking points to Scott McClellan to protect Scooter when the criminal investigation began, because the White House had, you know, it said Karl Rove wasn't involved, but they didn't mention anyone else. They had to come out and say Scooter Libby wasn't involved. Turns out they were lying in both counts. But nevertheless, you know, Dick Cheney was very actively involved and was gathering information and giving it actually to his underlings. Scooter Libby in this case. So,
but above all else, just for in case any blogging heads viewers haven't been paying attention, and that is the basic idea that the White House and the Vice President's office would see it differently, that the White House would see it as their mission to exculpate Karl Rove, and the OVP, the Office of the Vice President, would see it as their mission to exculpate Scooter Libby, or conversely take Rove down with them, whichever way it went.
Right.
That's not the image that I think even pretty hardcore observers at this White House had 2 weeks ago.
No, I mean, it does seem there are a lot of differences there, and there have been episodes that have been talking about that demonstrate that. But I still have to figure out how to make sense out of the Miller mess today when we finish here, and I'll be posting something of that. But there's a lot of other news out there. But before we turn to that, we left last blogging heads, which was we were talking about the State of the Union to come, with a cliffhanger. It was Jim Pinkerton predicting that there'd be a tax increase coming out of the, read his lips, Bush administration. George W., not George Bush, Daddy Bush. So, were you proven correct, sir?
Well, I think I was.
Well, explain to our audience what happened.
I've been thinking for a long time that the pressure on this President Bush to raise taxes, to be part of some deal on entitlement spending, it's just going to be overwhelming. And I think that the refusal to take absolute Sherman-esque pledges on no tax increase, no negotiations, no nothing, that have been so visible in the White House in the last few months, including Karl Rove to me personally, has convinced me that something is afoot, that Treasury Secretary Paulson has some grand bargain in mind, not unlike perhaps what Dick Darman was doing in 1990 in the Bush 41 administration, which I was a firsthand witness to. So I've always suspected something of that was happening. And then, of course, in the State of the Union itself, the President proposed his health care plan, which is probably DOA on Capitol Hill, but nonetheless, as the Washington Post said on the next day, and I'm sure we'll provide the link to blogging as viewers, this is a tax increase on 30 million Americans, on those Americans who spend more than $15,000 a year on their health care plans. Now, that you can argue that's good fiscal policy or bad fiscal policy or bad health care policy or whatever you want, but the reality that it is a tax increase on a pretty big swath of upper middle class and highly paid, as in union jobs, America, is undeniable. So I feel vindicated in my prediction, if nothing else.
Well, five words you just mentioned intrigued me. Karl Rove to me personally. So Karl Rove looked you in the eye and said, no new taxes?
He looked me in the eye and
where
said...
Where was this?
I'm sorry?
Where was this?
This was here in Washington.
Okay.
He said...
In his office? At
a
sauna? Where? I mean, where? On the sidewalk? Did you accost him on the street? Someone set it up for us.
It was an undisclosed location.
Okay.
but he said, listen, I understand what happened in 1990, and I have to tell you, this is a different White House and a different budget director and a different president. And although we're going to talk to the Democrats, we're going to negotiate with them, we're not going to agree to any tax increase. And I said, okay, we'll just wait and see, won't we? And I'll tell you right now, I think that Karl Rove fully understands that a tax increase, that actually goes through and gets enacted, would be a major blow to what remains of the Bush political coalition, with the Grover Norquist of the world, being so resolute on the no new taxes, keep the pledge issue. And Bush did, in fact, sign the Grover Norquist pledge on June 8th, 1999. I just happen to know that.
You walked around with it in your pocket, right? Laminated, I bet.
Exactly. And so, I mean, Grover certainly remembers. Anyway, so if Bush does it, it will happen, but it will happen at a pay grade, if you will, even higher than Karl Rove. I think Karl Rove will be against it, but Secretary Paulson and the Democrats on Capitol Hill will say, listen, if you want to fund the Iraq war in fiscal year 2009, you have to come forward on this.
Well, that's a happy thought. That's a happy thought. Speaking of the we'll watch you. Okay, 2009. Speaking of the Iraq war, we often talk a lot about Iraq, maybe not so much today, but one piece that appeared in the Washington Post today caught my eye, and it was on page A12, and I remember Izzy Stone once saying of the Washington Post, you know, it's a great newspaper, you'll never know where you'll find a page one story. And I thought this was probably a page one story. It was a story saying that there isn't enough equipment for the troops, the 21,500 troops that are part of the search. And it quoted, you know, by name, some leaders of the military have testified to Congress about this recently. And, they, you know, a lot of double talk about, oh, we're going to get up, we're going to catch up to that. And but then privately they still express concerns that they won't be able to. And we're talking about trucks, armored Humvees and other things. And it just got me thinking. You know, we are a superpower, at least we'd like to think we are. We're talking about putting in 21,500 troops, which is not a tremendously large number, you know, in the grand scheme of our army. And we can't get these troops into Iraq, where we're already situated, in a couple weeks' time, or a month or so, even they were talking about months down the line, even within a month or two, with the proper equipment. Now, you know, Bush and others have said repeatedly that the war in Iraq has not stretched our army too thin, and we're still capable of dealing with other contingencies that might arise in other parts of the world. Seems to me that's just a load of crap, that we're sitting in a, you know, a big truck with flat tires. If you can't get 21,000, you know, forces into an area that you're already, you know, that you're already operative in, with the right number of trucks over a couple months' time, then you're not really being honest when you say we're ready to go anywhere at any time.
I agree completely, and whether or not one supports or opposes the Iraq war, and I think, David, you and I, to our credit, opposed it all along. Nonetheless, you still have to just muse over the prospect there might be a war that's absolutely necessary, a good war, if you will, and then you'd want to be ready. And
this you is just have the trucks.
Well, this is right. This is something that's vexed me a great deal. I mean, I live in Northern Virginia. My next door neighbor is a retired lieutenant colonel in the Army. You know, he had a son in Iraq, mm-hmm. he had a daughter-in-law in Iraq. I mean, you know, the list of people who I know, you know, on the floor of my apartment building, who are in the military is long. Let alone the rest of my zip code. Let alone the rest of my state. Let alone the rest of my country. And so I've had a great deal of occasion to talk to them about exactly these sorts of issues about equipment and so on. And especially this phenomenon of the IED, the improvised explosive device. And I have said, so in effect, you're telling me that when your son, nephew, brother, husband goes on a mission, that it's pretty much guaranteed that they'll run across one, two, or three improvised explosive devices as they ride along. Yes, that's what I'm telling you. Okay. So in other words, you're telling me then that the whole country, or at least big chunks of it, are like a minefield. Yes, that's what I'm telling you. And I said, well, okay, well, in past wars that we didn't want to lose, what did we do when we wanted to, and what did militaries in general do when they didn't want to have their soldiers blown up with mines? Well, the answer is they used aggressive, energetic technology to deal with mines, to have counter-mine strategies. Yeah. Right now, our strategy appears to be, like, ride around, look for them, and hope you don't get blown up. Well, that's no strategy, and the reality of casualties and sort of the demoralization of American public opinion on this score is proof of that. So I went sort of clicking around on, you know, Googling and so on to look at past battles and how past militaries dealt with minefields. And I think there's a valuable illustration here, if I can belabor the point.
Please,
for a moment.
If we have any chance to educate our audience on the history of battle.
Well, okay,
I'm all for that. Here, that way they don't have to go to the History Channel and watch
that. They don't. That's right. They can go to Blogcast TV and serve all their needs. And so I looked up the Battle of Kursk, K-U-R-S-K, which is in the Soviet Union. It was the Nazis versus the Soviets. It was the last big German offensive of at least on the Eastern Front of World War II. And the Soviets knew the Germans were going to attack there because they cracked the codes. Yeah. And so the Soviets built 15 miles of minefields. Okay, fair. That's what, you know, good defensive work.
Yes.
And the Germans knew this was happening, and so the Germans used what it was sort of a radical new technology for 1943, which was they built little robot trucks that would drive out in the middle of the field, explode, and blow up the mines with them.
Yeah.
Now this is pretty hip technology for 1943. It didn't work. The Germans still lost the battle, but as one goes elsewhere in World War II, in the Western Front, in the Americans, when we invaded France and we faced, again, a whole country full of mines, we had this giant, we called it the flail. It was this thing that was like on a tank
that
would flop forward about 30 feet and smash anything underneath it and explode the mine. Now, I submit to you that in the 65 years since robot tank explosions and flails, there hasn't been an equivalent evolution in anti-mine technology. There's been lots of exploration and discovery on cruise missiles and, you know, radios and, you know, close, you know, microelectronics and so on. But the military has just chosen, as they're busy building the F-35 and, you know, the latest generation of submarines and supercarriers, to neglect the basic blocking and tackling, if you will, that keeps our men and women alive in a war zone. I find that reprehensible in the extreme.
Well, this
gets poor use of resources.
It gets to, you know, to the rhetorical point I made when I blogged about this early day while taking a break from the Libby trial, and that is, you know, the whole notion of supporting our troops. It's something that we argue about left, right, pro-war, anti-war, over and over again. But if you're not sending the troops into battle with the right trucks and the right equipment and the right armor, well, what does that say about supporting them? And this administration, if you go, you know, you can look at the, you know, the whole controversy over body armor, and in the course of the last 3-4 years, we've seen again and again assurances that everything's fine, and then congressional testimony or good investigative reporting, a variety of source of media outlets, saying it's not fine. And this is just sort of the latest chapter in this very depressing tale.
Right, and again, even from Bush's point of view, in terms of wanting to prosecute the war for a good long time to come, you would think that he would have sat down with Rumsfeld and you know, the Joint Chiefs and for that matter the Congress and said, listen, we're grossly underinvesting in military technology. Now, what do we have to raise taxes to do this? Do we have to run a bigger deficit? Those are things to argue about. But I think what you and I as patriots would both agree on is you can't argue about sending men and women into harm's way without adequate technology.
I mean, it's not like they woke up one day and there was a truck shortage. I mean, I assume they have, you know, software that keeps track of the trucks going out and the ones that don't come back. And, you know, if you have to, you put more money in and you try to gin up. But that's what I just find so it's one of the things I find most disgusting about this war, right or wrong in terms of its intent and purposes and goals and stated aims. You know, the people who have been prosecuting it from the beginning, even in terms of the planning, have just not acted like adults.
I agree, and there'll be much analysis of this inside the military as well as everywhere else, and there should be external analysis. We should be studying, just like the mistake we studied all the mistakes in past wars. There'll be a long list here, and among them, and this is a point that many people made 4 years ago, is the president didn't ask the American people for a sacrifice.
Hell yeah.
He said, well, listen, folks, I know
it was, you know, it was like, we can put this war on your credit card, and you'll get miles. Well, whoop-de-doo.
But and go shopping. I mean, we all had the occasion, perhaps, to see the movie Flags of Our Fathers. You know,
I actually watched it with my father, who passed away 2 weeks ago. It was one of the last things we did. And he had been in the Battle of Iwo Jima on a destroyer.
Wow.
No, he was on the island after it was sort of not in the.
But he was right there in the kamikaze zone.
But his destroyer got hit a couple times, and I think 23 people were killed on it.
What was the name of your dad? We should just remember him for a moment.
Kenneth R. Corn.
And what ship was it?
I have the clips, but I don't remember the name of the ship.
Okay, we should just take a moment. Honor your father and honor all the other people who fought there and so on. And then remember, in addition, that President Roosevelt and then President Truman were asking people to dig deep in their pockets for war bonds, which were not a particularly good investment.
No.
Anyway, I mean, I just, that's a poignant note to remind people that when we get careless with equipment, it's somebody's father or brother or would-be father.
Or wife or mother these days.
Exactly.
I mean, it's flags of our mother, father and mother now these days. But let's move on to the next thing, because it ties in here. You wrote a piece, I don't know if it's out yet, but you...
It came out today.
Came out today, on Chuck Hagel, who is a Vietnam vet, a Republican. He has now sort of taken the maverick Republican mantle from John McCain, and he sort of like whops him over the head with it almost every day.
Right. I said that Chuck Hagel is the new John McCain, and of course, John McCain is the new Bob Dole.
I know which part of that deal I like better there. And Chuck Hagel voted for the war, essentially, but he actually at the time raised a lot of the right questions. Are we prepared? Do we know how to deal with this culture? Do we know how to bring democracy there? You know, but he still went ahead and voted to give Bush the power to invade Iraq. But he's had his questions ever since, and in the last couple of months, he's become very vocal in talking about what's gone wrong. And he's now has joined with Senator Joe Biden, a Democrat, in pushing forward a resolution to say we're against the surge and we are against the way the war is being run. So pick it up there with what you and tell
well,
save
right.
people the time from reading your column there.
Right. I'll talk fast just to get the whole column articulated here. Hagel has done all those things. Like McCain, the liberal-leaning media love him because just like they loved McCain 5 years ago because he was a reliable, independent voice and a Bush basher, frankly. They like that, too. Now that McCain has become a friend of Bush, I can't believe in his heart of hearts he likes Bush any more than he used to, you know, in South Carolina. But nonetheless, at least ostensibly, he's Bush's best friend. McCain has lost his value to the media, and Hagel has picked up value. So Hagel's now the one who literally has the glowing profile in GQ magazine, which is certainly not a magazine that normally spends a whole lot of time on politics, unless the political figure they're covering makes some valuable point
for them,
as did McCain years and years ago when he was on in GQ, and now Hagel's got the same treatment, and it's a glowing treatment. And again, Hagel served in Vietnam. He won two Purple Hearts. He's earned all his cred as a military figure. And my only point I made in the column at Newsday.com was that Hagel is not on a path to get the Republican nomination. The old John McCain could not get nominated by the Republican Party, as he discovered in 2000. The new John McCain might well, because like Bob Dole in 1996, the Republicans demonstrated that if you hang around long enough, they'll give you the nomination, even though there's not much chance by the time you get it that you'll actually win the White House.
Well, McCain probably starts off now with much better chance than Bob Dole did. But at the end of your piece, I'm not going to let you off the hook here. You talked about the fact that Chuck Hagel is indeed considering a run for the presidency, and I would like nothing more than to see him get into the Republican primary and have this debate between him and John McCain, a substantive debate on the war in Iraq. I think it would be one of the highlights of any presidential campaign we've seen in years. But what you said was you raised the prospect of Chuck Hagel running as an independent. Come on, get real. What are you smoking? Who can run as an independent?
Ross Perot did it.
Yeah, with his $2 billion of his own money at a time when people wanted a crank in the White House.
Okay, so suppose the ticket were Hagel-Bloomberg, or Bloomberg-Hagel. And Bloomberg was on the cover of New York Magazine.
So you have the GQ New York Magazine.
That's right. Another part of the axis of fashion is New York Magazine. And they had Bloomberg on the cover, and they just said, they had a 10-page article, said, oh, well, he might run. And they interviewed all sorts of people who said, you know, like including Michael Steinhardt, who's a pretty heavy player in sort of liberal or sort of semi-liberal Democratic politics, saying, oh, yeah, I'd love for him to run. I can't remember exactly what it was, but it was certainly something that was extremely favorable to the idea of Bloomberg running. I'm sure that, look, all the changes in the media in the last 5 or 10 years, or sort of the collapse of much of the media and so on, have broken down old media structures and so on. They've also made it possible to create a new one, you know, like Blogheads TV. I mean, what could be newer and hotter than that? And so if Bloomberg or Hagel or you know, anybody else we can think of who's a big name and who's got some name ID and some money, can just jump in there and say, listen, I've got a website, I've got a campaign.
Well, if this was a sports talk show, which it isn't yet, I'd come up with some colorful way of telling you that you're nuts. But, I take your point, but I just still think that that we're far away from that. And I think that ultimately, Hagel, maybe even Bloomberg, are just not unconventional enough to take advantage and be the pioneers, the revolutionaries that one would have to be to take advantage of these new opportunities.
Well, we'll make a small bet on that offline, and then we'll proceed and cluck about this to somebody's benefit 6 months from now?
Well,
or a year from now.
Okay, we can. Before we go, we can make this a shorter blogging heads than usual because my wife will kill me if I don't get home soon. conservatives, you know, had a conference and they seem to be bitching and moaning that there's no natural conservative to lead them to victory in the 2008 election. Some don't see McCain. Certainly it's not Chuck Hagel. Do you see this as becoming a crisis for conservatives, or will this sort of sort itself out in the long run?
Yeah, I'm not too worried about the future of conservatism. I think that demographics alone, the kind of arguments that my friend here at the New America Foundation, Phil Longman, has made about who has children, guarantees that the conservative movement is going to do fine, not just in America, but also, frankly, around the world. I think that conservative nationalism is kind of the wave of the future. I think it represents...
Well, maybe I should start propagating even more. But one thing before we go, because we should plug our superiors. Mickey Kaus on Kaus Files, was dumping on Chuck Hagel. I don't know if you saw that.
I did see that.
The other day, for taking the coward's approach by coming against the war at this point, thinks the courageous thing now would be to support the war. I've noticed, I don't know if you have, it's sort of vague. I think Mickey, as he gets on in years, is getting even a little bit more conservative in certain matters. But we'll put that link up to the side, too, so people can see for themselves. And with that,
I can't think of anything Bob Wright's done. But he'll probably jump in and assert himself if he has to.
Okay.
So if there's anything that he's written lately, we'll just throw it in just for hell of it.
Well, then let me say my favorite words of the last couple of days: "Court stands in recess."